If you haven't heard, we're doing it big on Thursday, October 3rd in Los Angeles. That's the date for the Trapital Summit. This is the first summit that Trapital is hosting, and this is going to be the place for the innovators, the builders, and the visionaries that are pushing music and entertainment forward. We have a curated lineup of some of the top leaders in the industry that are doing things big, and they're going to be joining us for fireside chat conversations. You'll hear from Issa Rae, Tunji Balogun from Def Jam, Troy Carter from Venice Music, Kakul Srivastava from Splice, Charisse Clark Suarez from Harborview Equity Partners, Denis Ladegiri from Believe, Elias Seaton from SoundCloud, and more. I am really excited about this, and the thing I'm really excited about is that we're doing things a little bit differently. We've all been to the conferences where there's so many people on stage, so many people that are at the panel. You want to hear from some of them a lot more than others, but no, we're keeping the bar high and we're having deep conversations and real conversations with the people that are actually making moves in this industry. So you can get your tickets now. Tickets are on sale now. You can click the link in our show notes that bring you directly to the website. And anyone listening to this episode can get a 10% discount. Use the code RUNCIE. That's my last name. That's RUNCIE. And get 10% off your ticket. This is going to be a dope event. I'm really excited about it. And I hope you are too. See you there. Hey, welcome to Trapital. I'm your host, Dan Runcie. This is your place to gain insights on the business that shapes music, media, and culture. We dive deep into the companies and moguls who start the trends that shape the rest of the business world. It's been a few months since the Department of Justice filed its lawsuit against Live Nation Ticketmaster. The lawsuit claims that Live Nation Ticketmaster monopolizes markets across the live concert industry and is calling for the two companies to be broken up. Now, there's a lot to dig into here after reading this lawsuit, but it's also a great opportunity to take a step back and look at all of the factors that affect the live entertainment industry. And one of the biggest ones is the secondary markets, and looking at the role that companies like StubHub and SeatGeek and Vivid Seats play, and the resellers that use those platforms, and how they can shift the entire economics of the market, but also the fan experience when they can buy up tickets that would otherwise go to fans, set them for much higher prices, which can lead to a very distorted fan experience, especially for these highly sought after shows like Bad Bunny, Beyonce, Taylor Swift, and more. And that's just one of the several factors that influences things. We talked about a whole bunch of them on this episode, and I'm joined by Larry Miller, who is a professor from NYU. He runs the Steinhardt Program, which focuses on the music business, and he recently wrote an op-ed in Variety, which talks about this Live Nation DOJ lawsuit and calls some of the issues into question. He was the perfect person to have on to break this all down with. I really enjoyed this conversation, so let's dive in. All right, today we're here to talk about Live Nation, DOJ, and this ongoing lawsuit and drama. And we're joined today by Larry Miller from NYU. First time on the pod. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm so glad to be here. Dan, what took us so long? But here we are.
We've had so many conversations in other settings, so it's about time that we actually had this one. And we're having this because you recently put out a op-ed that you had shared in Variety about this lawsuit. Last year, we had did a panel that you invited me to. You hosted it down in LA. Zach Iser was on the panel, Jonathan Daniel from Crush. You had Dana Frank as well, and it was a good conversation. And your piece reminded me a lot of the viewpoint you made the argument that the DOJ's case against Live Nation and Ticketmaster breaking up has some holes in it and probably needs a bit more taking a step back to understand what's really going on. You got a lot of feedback on it, especially on LinkedIn. I saw you reply to a lot of the feedback. Before we get into the merits of the piece, let's talk about the feedback you received, because I'm sure you probably received a fair amount privately as well. What was your take? Do you feel like it landed the way you expected it to?
I did. And first of all, thanks for reaching out and connecting on this topic. You and I have talked a lot about lots of issues in recorded music and music publishing and streaming and rates and fandom and all sorts of things. Probably never would have come around to doing an op-ed about Live Nation or ticketing were it not for the DOJ case. And I read the case, and over the last couple of years, in academic classes that we run at NYU about the live business, when we talk about ticketing and when we talk about Ticketmaster and the other platforms, and when we talk about Live Nation as a competitor, one of the things that we always have to explain is what Live Nation's business model actually is and what Ticketmaster does and what they're really good at, which is selling a lot of tickets really fast and 99% of the time having that work well and implementing the requirements of the artist and the artist team and the promoter and venue. Ticketmaster, which has absorbed the ire of music fans for decades, what they get is something on the order of 5 to 7% of the ticket price for the service that they provide. Ticketmaster does not set ticket prices. Ticketmaster does not set fees. Fees are set by venues and promoters. Ticket prices are set by artists and their managers and agents, the artist team. Ticketmaster is like a massive war room that is really good at implementing all of that stuff really well, very fast, over and over again at scale. And so, as much as fans in particular, I think, love to beat up on Ticketmaster for high prices and junk fees and so on, actually, they're not really responsible for any of that stuff. And look, it's not like Live Nation isn't a very aggressive competitor. A very aggressive competitor. They are. But does this merit the level of antitrust litigation that they're needing to deal with now? I'm not sure about that.
I think part of the increase for the heightened scrutiny with this too came after the Taylor Swift on sale and the crashing of Ticketmaster during that. The challenge, though, was that there were other ticket sellers that had Taylor Swift tickets that they put on sale as well, and their systems also crashed. I'm talking specifically about SeatGeek. So this wasn't just a problem that was native to Ticketmaster itself, but then more broadly, that heightened some of the frustration that people had because people talk about how high the ticket prices are and how inaccessible it is. But at the end of the day, this is a product that is underpriced. A lot of consumers may feel that they're high. They may feel that the Ticketmaster and other primary resellers are selling them at high prices. But we haven't even talked yet about the secondary market, which adds a layer onto this that, depending on who you ask, some people feel like it meets the market where the demand is. Other feels like it increases the price. And it does flip the economics in a way that it's truly hard to think about for any other industry. I was looking back at some old articles. There was one from 2013, New York Times article, that was talking about how there are few other industries like ticketing where the product itself is so underpriced that you have literally a business next door that is going to double that price and then sell it. So essentially, you turn the primary seller of the ticket into almost a wholesaler, a B2B company that then sells it to the more consumer facing platform, which is the secondaries. And that just leads to all these issues because the secondary market isn't regulated. If you want to talk about fees, those companies often take a higher take rate for the particular service that they have. And especially in concerts, even more so than sports, the frequency of people seeing their favorite artists is much less frequent, especially as more and more demand increases for these tickets. It's not that I think that any of the merits from DOJ don't have warrant, but I wish that the arguments were more focused on having a true understanding for how this really works and the outcomes that would happen from the intended requests from this lawsuit and other issues and complaints that have been publicized.
Yeah, the headline in my Variety op-ed about this was that if the DOJ is successful in forcing a breakup of Live Nation, the concert business, and Ticketmaster, the ticketing business, which it has owned since 2010, after the Obama DOJ approved that merger with some modifications and a relatively light consent decree, that we shouldn't expect ticket prices to go down. If high ticket prices is one of the drivers of interest in this antitrust case, I don't think any sensible person ought to assume that by breaking up the largest ticketing platform and the largest concert company will cause ticket prices to be any lower than they are now. I did suggest some other remedies that might more directly cause ticket prices to become a little bit more affordable, but breaking up Live Nation and Ticketmaster is not one of them.
Agreed. And if we look at the history of DOJ and antitrust pushes to break up companies, when have they ever led to lower prices? You could go back to Standard Oil in 1911. Sure, there may be some increased competition in different areas, but one, a lot of those companies just were secretly owned by the same person. And two, it didn't lead to that intended outcome. But then even more recently, but 40 plus years ago, when AT&T broke up as well, there were cheaper calls for long distance, but not for the local calls, which is where a majority of them were. So one business couldn't subsidize the other. And I think something that gets missing here is, I understand there's thoughts that the lack of competition in certain areas, it doesn't necessarily lead to lower prices, because the economies of scale of these types of companies allows for the consumer to enjoy the lower prices, which is how these companies got scale to begin with. If you go back to the 90s with SFX and before, a lot of the concert promotion companies combined together to then form what we now know as Live Nation, this was a very fragmented industry that there's a very weak history of breaking up companies and then that then actually leading to lower prices for consumers.
Yeah, fair enough. I've been thinking a lot about AT&T lately. I worked there in AT&T Labs Research just after the so-called trivestiture, when AT&T went this way and Lucent went that way. And of course, the long-distance business did what it did. And we had the creation of the various regional Bell operating companies. But what is today Verizon was one of those, for example. But anyway, we digress. And I don't think anybody's telephone service has declined in price. And maybe that is a topic for another day. On the other hand, when I went to write the piece and Variety agreed to put it out there in fairly short order, I really expected a fair amount of pushback, especially from my friends in the independent promoter community and the NEVA people who are part of my life and part of my network. And honestly, I didn't hear from anybody in that community. I heard a lot, as you pointed out, on LinkedIn especially, from people who were supportive and they appreciated the piece and so on. But I expected more direct criticism, and I didn't get any at all.
You really didn't. The people that are really in it do understand how the industry works. But for some reason, that hasn't translated to Congress. That hasn't translated to the Hill. And these are very smart people that understand how bills work, how laws work. And you need to understand who sets what for pricing. But that hasn't translated to lawsuits or push from a legal perspective that reflects an understanding for how this business works. Unless I'm missing something. But what's your take on that?
My takeaway is that everybody hates Ticketmaster, and Live Nation is in the minds of many regulators and politicians and perhaps many fans too darn big, and that somebody should do something about that. With all due respect to Senator Klobuchar and the others on the committee and their staffs, that Live Nation is being used as a political football to score points in this administration. And although I am not an expert in antitrust law, I'll be surprised as this litigation goes on to see whether in this administration or perhaps the next one, whether the suit is successful and forces a breakup or not. And again, if primary ticket pricing is a primary complaint here, then nobody should expect tomorrow to look very different from today. And to be clear, I do believe that regulating the secondary market is essential in reining in prices in the primary market. And although I have not done a gigantic amount of research and analysis on that point, it stands to reason that artists want to play to full houses that are packed full of real, authentic fans, and that many artists, especially many larger artists, tend to underprice in the primary market tickets to ensure that the on sale goes clean and that they're playing to real fans. On the other hand, the secondary market in the United States is almost completely unregulated. The secondary market, including StubHub and SeatGeek, have organized very well on Capitol Hill and in state capitals to ensure that secondary market sales of sports and concert tickets can happen in an utterly and uncontrolled way. And when that happens, especially in music, I think, it's clear how much value is being hoovered up by the secondary market players who are taking no risk. They are investing no capital in building better buildings or in providing better fan experiences in the venue. They're just operating a two-sided marketplace. And in some cases, like when the biggest artist in the world goes on tour and the demand for those tickets is virtually infinite, we get the result that we got. And I think that many fans and many parents of fans wrote to their local congressperson or senator, in especially in Minnesota, and we are now seeing the result of that.
The regulation on the secondary market, especially on the price cap for tickets, is something that we've seen in other countries and other parts of the world. Australia has this, UK has this to some extent, but the strongest example is probably in Australia, where the secondary market prices are capped at 10% above the primary ticket value there. And they had Taylor Swift tickets less than $200 for some of the shows, which is maybe a fifth or a tenth of the price of what we saw in other markets.
And there are reports of Taylor tourism that was fueled by that pricing imbalance, and that there were people who bought plane tickets to Western Europe or to Sydney or to someplace in Asia and went to see Taylor in those places and actually spent less than they would have had they gone to see her in, say, New York or Los Angeles.
Let's take a break for our Chartmetric stat of the week. An artist's ability to generate streams is not always correlated with an artist's ability to sell concert tickets. And one great example is Lizzo. As of August 11th, she has 5.73 million Spotify followers, which is 559th on the platform. But Lizzo's part of a much smaller group of contemporary artists who have the ability to sell out a nationwide arena tour in the United States. And at the end of the day, that's the important metric. Who cares about followers? Who cares about streams? How many people can you get to pay to come see you, leave their house and come see you in person? And Lizzo is one of those people where the real number matters more than the superficial ones. Let's get back to the episode. And I think we're going to continue to see that just based on the way things are going. The demand for these once-in-a-generation artists that go on tour every 3 to 4 years in these mega stadiums around the world, those events become more exclusive, and the price for those just continue to increase as a result. And one of these things where there's constant options and more artists trying to go on tour, more things in general competing for your attention, that just drives more attention to these Taylor Swifts and Beyoncés, these megastars. So unless there is regulation there, I don't see that happening or changing. But I do wonder if we will see some type of shift in tide about the secondary resellers too. But as you mentioned as well, their lobbyists are strong. I think part of the history and journey of StubHub is having success getting these laws changed in Pennsylvania, in New York, in Florida, in major states like that. So I think there are many parts of the entertainment world that you could circle and lean back to, okay, why does this challenge still exist? It's because of strong lobbyists. And I think that ticketing can remain one, especially if we continue to direct attention in the areas where, if we're trying to solve the problem, are we really focusing on the right area? Because another thing that I think about too is we talk a lot about the supply and demand piece of, let's say Taylor Swift went on tour 4 times a year as opposed to once every 4 years, the ticket prices will probably look a little bit different. But she's one person. It's hard for her to be like the New York Yankees and play 81 home games a year. That's just not how these things work. But still, even if you increase the supply, I do think that would help to an extent, but we're still in rare territory where I think that live concerts experience this even more than sporting events do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we understand what some of the drivers are for why that is the case at the very top end of the live concert market, especially now that music itself is like a utility. To quote and plug my friend Lars Murray's podcast, Unlimited Supply, music is just, it's everywhere and it's in everything. And David Bowie once said that music would flow like water, and it certainly flows more like a waterfall today. We are drowning in it. And yet to have that unique, unduplicatable, unless you go on tour with the artist, experience is something that fans value a lot. But I don't think this is just the case for the Taylors and Beyoncés of the world. This is what the live business has become. And when we layer on the tools and communication platforms that we have today in social media, and everybody wants everybody else to know what great places and experiences they're having, it metastasizes the entire dynamic. And so I don't see that changing anytime soon. But to be fair, Taylor, Beyonce, Springsteen, the handful of other artists who face virtually infinite demand still represent only a tiny fraction of the artists who go on tour every year. And I think much of the content in the case is less about the superstar touring acts and the way ticketing works for those people as it is for how it works with promoters and venues and how booking actually works and trying to cure a very complex, highly dynamic live music ecosystem. I don't know that this case is going to be able to do that. One of the things that I point out in the op-ed is that if this is about pricing, let's start with regulating the secondary market and then reverse engineer the rest of this. But we may have, in this case, a once-in-a-generation opportunity to maybe reinvent the way the live music business system works. And for me, I would rather do it in the marketplace than see it forced as a result of antitrust litigation. And maybe you can talk to an actual lawyer about that someday, but I don't really see the merits of the antitrust case as it's written and about to be prosecuted.
Agreed. You mentioned the venues and the contracts that the primary ticketing companies have. And the one part of the case that they did allude to was the Barclays Center situation. Mm-hmm. And for those listening, that was one of the examples where Ticketmaster had an ongoing relationship with the Barclays Center in Brooklyn as the primary ticketing company for that venue. This is an area that has become much more competitive since the 2010 merger. And in 2021, the group that owns the Barclays announced that they would be switching from Ticketmaster to SeatGeek. SeatGeek, of course, started as a similar competitor to StubHub by focusing primarily on the secondary market. But SeatGeek wanted to disrupt the primary as well. And they had the exclusive partnership with Barclays Center to do that. But after just over a year, they announced it in early 2023, Barclays was going to be switching back to Ticketmaster, which it has, and it's now been Ticketmaster for over a year now. There's a few things to dig into here, because on one hand, the folks at SeatGeek claimed that there were some retaliatory efforts because there were a number of arena show level concerts that could have been promoted and hosted at the Barclays Center, but weren't, because the years before there were dozens of shows that had happened through the calendar year, but there were only 13 that had happened in that time span that SeatGeek had the exclusive partnership with Barclays. There, the pushback on that, which Live Nation and others have said, is that SeatGeek's technology wasn't up to the task and up to the requirements that the Barclays Center owner group would have wanted. What's your thoughts on that whole situation?
So on the Barclays case, one, we learned, and I think SeatGeek learned, that primary ticketing is harder than it looks. This is not easy, folks. Do not try this at home, especially if you're a secondary market player trying to move into the primary market. The second part of this, I think, addresses the consent decree that was part of the approval for the original merger. And there has been a monitor looking over Live Nation's shoulder to help ensure that retaliatory measures were not being taken and that Live Nation was, in fact, complying with the consent decree. And I don't know if I'm Michael Rapino or anybody at Live Nation or Ticketmaster New York, although I'm going to compete hard to ensure that my service is available at every venue and at every point of presence possible, that I'm also going to make sure that I'm not going to trip over my own feet and cause the DOJ or anybody else to cry foul.
And I'd be curious to hear what SeatGeek's other partners in this business have had to say. They have a few exclusives with the Dallas Cowboys, with the Washington Commanders. But you're right. I think that the ease of creating events online and having people purchase events on Eventbrite or even on Luma and platforms like that had people overestimate how easy it is to just say, oh, here's the inventory, here's how many tickets I'm selling to this event, and this is where the venue is. And I do think that Ticketmaster's technology to pull this off gets a bit overlooked. It doesn't have that same connection where I think that the average consumer could probably understand. I may not be able to create the network effects of an Amazon. Walmart Plus has tried to do it for years and has gotten better, but still hasn't quite gotten there. I just can't create my own Shopify page and replicate Amazon. But for whatever reason, people think that it's easier than it looks. And I know that whether it's SongKick and other companies have came through and challenged the Live Nation Ticketmaster, but more specifically Ticketmaster in this space. But I'm with you. I think this is a hard business and it isn't as black and white as, yes, these concerts that would have otherwise been at Barclays in 2023 were not there in 2023 because of retaliatory efforts. I don't know if that's necessarily something that's as easy to prove. I know that is probably one of the points of the case that they feel like maybe stronger than others, but it'll be interesting to see how that one plays out.
Yeah. And while we're talking about the other primary ticketing platforms, I think Dice is a fantastic product. Do you use Dice?
Yeah, I do. And they've been partners of the show. And their whole concept, which came from the UK, is there is no extra margin to capture on the resale. Whatever you pay, you're going to sell it for that price, and you're going to sell it for that price to another fan. And I think they've gotten good traction in a number of different cities since they've launched. It's an approach that I think is much more common in other countries than here.
It's a fantastic product. Dice works very well. If what you want to do is just ensure that your ticket goes to another fan and that you're not making a living off of the delta between what you paid for the ticket and what somebody else may be willing to pay. So kudos to Dice.
Let's say that you were the live events czar and you had the ability to wave a magic wand and fix one thing about this business. What do you think you would change?
Boy, there's a long list, but I would start with regulating the secondary market, honestly. I do think that there is a strong correlation between secondary market demand pricing and its impact back in the primary market, and that will do more than anything else to make for a fairer live music ecosystem. So I would, if I had to pick one thing, I would probably start there, and then I would move on to food and beverage and like making the overall fan experience quite a lot better than it is in some places.
Would artists raising their prices to meet the demand more so than underpricing the demand, and in many ways by raising their prices eliminate the margin that the secondary resellers can have, does that fall anywhere in your line in terms of what a potential solution could look like?
I don't think so, because on the one hand, artists want to price their tickets fairly, but they also want them to be accessible to people who don't run their own gigantically successful podcasts or work at a hedge fund. And I think it's in the artist's interest to ensure that your average fan can afford to go to a show. Rightly or wrongly, if it was only about revenue maximization, then we might be talking about a different answer. But I don't think it's just that. I think that they want to ensure that there are real fans in the seats and authentic fans who care about them and their music and know something about it can actually get a ticket.
I think that's fair. And I lead there too, because I do know that raising prices is probably a pure economic answer that doesn't take into account the broader experience with this, because then you price it out and then it doesn't necessarily become your most passionate fans. It becomes your wealthiest fans who also have enough passion to want to see you. If the prices are too high, then it becomes something like the Super Bowl, where it just becomes a bunch of corporate tickets. If I was live event czar as well, I do think that capping the resale is the best way to do this. And I know that would take a considerable hit to the secondary business. But again, those businesses don't have as much stake in the game. We recently did a StubHub breakdown episode on Trapital. In the beginning, those businesses were started because of how inefficient and shady the resale process was. If you had season tickets to something, you couldn't go to a show. You either had to hope a friend could do it or have someone scalp a ticket on your behalf in front of the stadium. And then people don't know if they can trust that person. It's a shady type of business. So I get that was the intent at the time, but it's now morphed into this thing where, in terms of the revenue that's generated from those businesses, I think more of it comes from the bots and the touts that are looking for profit and arbitrage opportunities, more so than a genuine fan that can no longer go and now wants to sell it to someone else. So
I noted that the StubHub IPO has been delayed again until
after Labor Day, I saw it was the day.
Yeah, sometime later this year. And I wonder if this Live Nation litigation and the possibility of any regulation of the secondary market might be having any kind of an overhanging effect on the StubHub IPO. I don't know.
That's a good question. The public reason that they've given is that it's a tough IPO market right now, which is fair. Interest rates are high. This isn't 2020 and 2021 anymore. Companies like Stripe and others have been waiting on their hands as well for their own IPOs. But Reddit had a pretty successful IPO this year, so it clearly isn't impossible to do. But the irony of a potential StubHub IPO while Live Nation Ticketmaster getting sued by the government for something that the secondary market is also responsible for is a very unique level of irony.
Yes, just wondering about it out loud here on the Trapital podcast.
Larry, before we close things out, anything else on Live Nation, Ticketmaster, DOJ?
Let's see. We covered a lot of territory. I don't know. If you're good, I'm good. Would be happy to hear from Trapital listeners on this who might, whether they agree or disagree.
Yeah, I'm interested too. We'll definitely plug this one. We'll share in the newsletter, get a sense for where people stand on this as well. And on all aspects of it, the SeatGeek piece of it, the consent decree, whether we'll see the extension of that. There's so many layers to dig into this, and it's an ongoing topic. we'll be interested to see where it continues. But Larry, thanks again for coming on. This is a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
See you soon. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.